In this week's underreported feature, we will take a look at an issue that's very close to home. The Business and Professional Women's Foundation estimates that, based on current trends, the wage gap between men and women in the U.S. won't be eradicated until 2039. As it stands, women must work 16 months in order to earn the wages paid to a man in 1 year. And if we look at how race impacts earnings gaps, well, we will see that African-American women earn 66 cents on the dollar, while Hispanic women earn just 55 cents on the dollar. Dr. Avis Jones-DeWeaver of the Institute for Women's Policy Research joins me now to put everything into context, and I'm very pleased to welcome her to my show today. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. It's been estimated that the average 25-year-old woman can expect to lose between $250,000 and $500,000 over the course of her lifetime to the wage gap. That's the cost of a home, isn't it?
It certainly is, and that's why we see that once we look at people in their latter years, in fact, it's women that are most likely to live in poverty.
Didn't the U.S. Census Bureau do a recent survey on earning gaps?
Yes, it was. Well, they do an annual survey that takes a look at the earnings of individuals across the nation, and they look at that compared with the level of education that individuals have. And what has really hit the news very hard regarding this year's release is the fact that for one of the very few times that this happened, African-American women actually have earned more than white women at the same level of education, that is, women with at least a bachelor's degree.
And that's gotten a lot of newspapers excited. Newsday's headline was "Good News and Hope for Black Women." Chicago Tribune wrote, "White women lag in pay among college graduates." The USA Today said, "Census, college-educated white women earning less." But how big are the earning gaps between college-educated Hispanic, white, African-American, and Asian women?
It's really not huge, and what's interesting to me is that the much bigger story is the gap between all of these women and white men. A white man, for example, with just a bachelor's degree earns on average about $66,000 per year. That compares to only $43,000 earned by Asian American women, which are the highest earning women. Under them are African American women who earn roughly $41,000, and then white women who earn roughly $38,000, and Latinas who earn only about $37,500. So everyone, in terms of women, we really need to have work about one and a half women. You need to kind of almost clone yourself to kind of earn the same sort of salary that your white male counterpart makes.
Some people are suggesting that it's misleading to present the census data from this perspective.
It's very misleading because what it sort of assumes is that white women are somehow being cheated, in essence, that they are supposed to earn more. So why, in fact, are they earning less?
Or isn't it just that the conventional wisdom would be that they do earn more?
That is the conventional wisdom, definitely. But what we found when we took a deeper look at this issue is that what's happening here is that black women are just working a whole lot more than their white female counterparts. For example, we found that over the course of the year, black women actually work about a month more than her white counterpart. So we work about 200 hours more than white women do.
So if there's a little more earned, what are we talking about, $3,000 or so, or actually $2,200 with a lot more hours worked, then black women aren't really earning more than white women?
Exactly. The hourly wage falls behind that of white women. So much so that if you look only at women who work full-time year-round, white women do, in fact, earn more than African-American women. So the earnings difference here is largely a function of how many hours one's work and how many jobs one work. And it largely has to do with the fact that I think black women, for example, are more likely to go back to work after having a child. They're more likely to go back to work sooner, and they're more likely to hold down more than one job.
What is the fact that college-educated African-American and Asian women are making more than white women mean?
I think it is largely a function of the type of choices that women have, particularly with regard to their family structure. For example, African-American women are the least likely demographic group to marry outside of her race. And so her household earnings are largely dependent on not only her earnings, but also the earnings of her spouse, who is most likely to be an African-American male. When we look at male earnings, white men earn the least, as I mentioned before, white men earn the most, but black men earn the least. And so white women have more options in terms of what to do, particularly after having a child, whether or not to go back to work, because she has that benefit of the white male salary that is largely not something that African-American women have in terms of an option.
Is there any evidence to support the theory that one of the reasons for the earnings gap is that minority women, especially African-American women, are more likely to hold more than one job or work more than 40 hours per week?
Exactly. That's largely a function of what's going on with African-American women. But interestingly, when we look at what's happening with Asian-American women, I think there's a little bit of a different story there. Asian-American women, for example, are more likely to hold degrees in jobs that typically are likely be held by men. For example, they're more likely to hold degrees in the hard sciences and the mathematics, and those types of jobs earn more, frankly, than jobs that other women hold that who have a bachelor's degree. For example, other women are more likely to become teachers, and college-educated teachers earn a lot less, for example, than a college-educated engineer. So the earnings power that Asian women get from their degree really provides them with more options in terms of their earning potential than is the case for other women.
Several editorials looking at this data have pointed out something that you mentioned earlier, that focusing on the small earning gaps amongst women is missing the bigger picture, which is presented by the survey, and that is that white men earn more money than anybody.
Exactly.
I mean, other than me, of course.
Well, white men is very interesting. With a bachelor's degree, as I mentioned before, earn roughly $66,000 a year, and that earnings level puts him at about $20,000 more per year of earnings as compared to his black male counterpart. So because of that huge gap, that kind of trickles down into the options that families have. The family earnings then that we find among different racial groups are greatly impacted by that. And so it allows white women the option, we think, to maybe work a little bit less hours and spend a little bit more time at home than is really something that's kind of realizable in terms of the lives of African-American families.
So the wage gap between Asian women and white women is $5,900, but the gap between white men and white women is $28,590.
Exactly, a huge gap there. And so really what we're talking about here, I think the biggest gap that people really need to pay attention to is the male-female gap versus the female gap among the races, across the races. Really, that is a very minuscule level of difference in the scheme of things.
What are the advantages and what are the disadvantages of looking at how women of different races compare in terms of earnings? Is this a political thing, do you think?
Well, this is something that we've been looking at historically in terms of the nation for many years, and it's good to have that sort of data available because we like to see what sort of progress we're making in terms of sort of breaking down the walls of discrimination that we have entrenched in the society from the very beginning. And so it's important as statisticians, as economists, as scholars, and just as individuals to really be able to keep track of how we're doing as a nation and providing individuals with an equal level of opportunity. So because of that, I think it's important to have that data, and it's important to have it broken down by race. But it's very dangerous when you misinterpret that data. I find that when a lot of people started to hear about these latest numbers, they started to assume things that were very kind of, in my opinion, very kind of out in left field. For example, they were assuming that the results that we found here with regards to African-American women somehow foretold some sort of reverse discrimination. It foretold some sort of need to kind of end affirmative action because black women had finally overcome, apparently. And I think all of those sort of predictions are very, very way off track, and they're not at all in line with reality when we look at, once again, why we find out this is the case. And as I mentioned before, it's largely because black women are just, frankly, working a lot more.
What would account for the $28,590 gap between college-educated white women and white men? Is that because women are more likely to take off time to raise children in the prime earning years?
That would be more of a function in terms of the lifetime earnings that you mentioned before, but not so much of a function of that specific year's earnings.
That's $76 to every dollar earned by 76 cents to every dollar earned by the average man.
Exactly. That has to do with the specific wage gap of individuals in their workplace today, that a woman can expect to, on average, make roughly about 25 cents less per hour in terms of her dollar than her male counterpart. And that has nothing to do with the fact that she's working less. There is a little bit of variance there if we take into consideration, for example, the level of experience and the level of education overall when we look at the wage gap in general, but it's still very minuscule. Still, when we look at those things and hold those things constant, we find that women still earn about 20 cents less on the dollar than men earn. So that's largely, I think, a function of two things. It definitely still is a function of existing levels of discrimination in the workforce in terms of people's perceptions regarding how much of a salary an individual needs to support a family. I think there's largely a perception out there that men are the wage earners, that men are the ones who are, in fact, supporting their family, so they somehow deserve more pay for the work that they do. But in addition to that, it's also a function of the types of jobs that men and women hold. Women tend to hold jobs that are, in fact, devalued in our society. The typical woman, as I mentioned before, might be a teacher, might be a child care worker, might be an administrator, or a secretary, or something of that nature. And the jobs that women typically hold typically earn less, typically pay less than the jobs that men hold.
Is that
even
because
at the same level of education?
Is that because those are the only jobs available, or because women tend to go into those kinds of jobs? Women seen as nurturers, so they wind up teachers and nurses.
It's definitely not because those are the only jobs available. Women do tend to go in those jobs, and I think it's a function of, frankly, the culture in our society that we kind of, people sort of assume, they sort of go into the things that they see other people like them going into. So I think it's very important that we sort of break those barriers down and let individuals know, particularly encourage our young girls to kind of think more broadly in terms of career opportunities and not limit herself to those things that she only sees other women do.
Well, one side of this argument is that the jobs that are predominantly done by women are less respected because they're considered women's work.
Exactly, exactly.
According to the Committee on Pay Equity, more than half of the country's 64.7 million women workers are in sales, clerical, and service jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the jobs that are available to them and may not be available to men who are looking for jobs?
They're also available to men. And interestingly, when we look at the statistics behind those types of jobs, even traditionally female jobs, we find that when men do in fact go in those jobs, they're still paid more. For example, if you look at male and female nurses, a relatively high-paying profession for a woman to go into, if a man goes into nursing, he still makes more than the woman does at the same level of education. So there is something there in terms of the types of jobs that individuals go into by gender and how jobs are valued or devalued depending upon whether or not it's perceived as a male or female job. But we also find that there still is a level of discrimination there. With regards to men who even go into traditionally female jobs, they still tend to earn more than women at the same profession.
Do women tend to choose jobs with good benefits but worse wages, more flexibility? Because that also has to be factored in.
Unfortunately, that would make sense, but it doesn't really seem to bear out in the numbers, because oftentimes those jobs that we mentioned that women typically go into, those service-oriented jobs, for example, those jobs are in fact least likely to have flexibility. They are least likely to have benefits. They're more likely to have a person in those jobs is less likely to have control over their time. For example, they might have to work one shift one week and another shift the next week. So it kind of wreaks havoc on her family life. So unfortunately, those jobs are really not the types of jobs that provide any level of sanity in terms of raising a consistent household. It really puts a lot of working poor families into quite a bind.
My guest is Dr. Avis Jones DeWeaver of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. We will continue this underreported segment after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Underreported and Dr. Avis Jones DeWeaver of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, talking about the earnings gaps, not just between men and women, but between men of different backgrounds and women of different backgrounds. I've read that studies have shown that the more an occupation is performed by women or people of color, the lower the pay.
Exactly.
So what happens is a job may pay well, but if suddenly, is this like the old neighborhood thing? If a lot of people move in, then suddenly the rents go down, it's harder to sell a building?
Somewhat, I think, but they're largely jobs that have historically gone to women or historically gone to people of color. I don't think they're jobs that, for the most part, have been primarily dominated, for example, by white men and then turned over, although that might be the case. I do think that happens more often with neighborhoods, for example, than it does with the tradition of job history. But that definitely is the case. And we think it's a matter, once again, of a cultural devaluation of a particular type of occupation because of the person who fills that occupation.
What do you think of Walmart's new campaign to appeal to women as a good employer?
Frankly, I think it's very disingenuous. In fact, Walmart, interestingly, has recently been sued by women. The largest sex discrimination suit in history was filed against Walmart, and that is because of their blatant history of being very discriminatory in terms of hiring and promotion, where women tend to be sort of bulked into the checkout positions, the lowest paid positions, without any sort of health care, without the ability to unionize, of course, where men are most likely to be in the management positions, and once again, the higher paid positions. And so it's very disingenuous. It's very interesting for me to sit back and watch these commercials with all these smiling women on there talking about how wonderful it is to work for Walmart, when I know the real story behind it is that actually this is really some huge public relations campaign to kind of counteract what actually is going on in real life.
How important is socialization? Are women less likely to ask for a raise than a man?
I think that's part of it. I think women largely are kind of socialized into this idea of that a good woman is one who is somewhat subservient, somewhat genteel, somewhat willing to get along and go along, per se, and that to speak up for oneself, to be seen as aggressive, is somehow seen as being, you know, a little rowdy, a little not feminine, a little unfeminine. And I think that's one of the things, for example, particularly that African-American women have been branded as being somewhat less feminine, because African-American women have a sort of history, and I think a history that has been delved into the need of for survival to be a bit more aggressive. And so there's this feeling that somehow she is probably less feminine and less valued in that sense.
I mentioned earlier the Business and Professional Women's Foundation estimate that, based on current trends, the wage gap between men and women in the U.S. will be eradicated around 2039, which is a year before Social Security is supposed to start facing its problems. But does that mean that the gap is narrowing each year, a little by little, until we get to 2039?
You know, that's an interesting projection, and but it's hard to say exactly, because it doesn't inch up and down. I mean, it kind of moves. It varies every year. For example, last year, 2 years ago, for example, the gap shrunk a little bit. And it wasn't so much that women were making more. Unfortunately, it was because men were making a lot less. It shrunk. But last year, we saw that it expanded. So it kind of goes up and it kind of goes down depending upon how the economy is doing. And frankly, depending upon how men's wages are doing more than how women's wages are doing. In fact, we found some research that we've done here at IWPR has found that for the past 17 years, the wage gap has pretty much relatively remained stagnant between men and women. So it's going to take a long time. I think that projection might be true, that it'll at least take that long before we see some sort of parity between men and women's earnings.
How much of a contributing factor is education? People with college degrees earn an average of almost three times more than people without high school diplomas, and almost twice what a high school grad earns. So does that apply across the boards?
Oh, yes. Education is a huge equalizer for women. For example, remember before I talked about how men at every level of education, frankly, earn more than women, but it's particularly important to be able to chip into that wage gap to at least have a college degree for women. For example, if you just look at individuals with no high school degree, men on average earn about 40% more than a woman does. Now, once you have a high school degree, men still outpace women's earnings by about 40%. It's not until we actually get to a college-level degree, or at least a four-year degree, that the poverty level between men and women is about equal. And so in order to get above poverty, it's particularly critical that women earn a college degree. And more women are, in fact, going to college now. So I think in terms of sort of getting that gap shrunk, it's critical that women continue to go to colleges and earn those degrees, because that's really her biggest chance to not only escape poverty but begin to chip into that wage gap.
Don't laws prevent companies from adjusting entry-level salaries? So if two people, a man and a woman, whether they're white or black, graduate with the same degree, shouldn't they at least start off with the same salary?
They should. should, but there is discretion there in terms of the employer. And the federal laws that most people think of as protecting us primarily only impact large organizations, large businesses. They don't really impact, they don't really apply, frankly, to small businesses. And most individuals in this nation are employed by small business owners. And so really there is no sort of strong oversight over them. And even in terms of the larger businesses, an employer can say, well, I just feel this person has, some sort of je ne sais quoi, some sort of background, some sort of experience that justifies their higher earnings that I'm going to give them. And so there is a little bit of flexibility there on the individual level in terms of what individuals are paid. There's definitely a salary range, for example, that everyone should be within, but within that range there are individual decisions that are made person by person, and I think that's what we see in terms of the results that we come out with when we look at the earnings difference that we find between the races and between the sexes. Frankly.
Is there any data on how the wage gap between men and women compares to men and women of the same age, and how that applies later to seniority, which has such an important impact on earnings?
That's an excellent point. There is some work on that, and we do find that younger women are, in fact, making a much greater strides in terms of chipping into that wage gap than her older counterparts. So as we begin to see some of our more senior employees sort of go into retirement and hopefully get that Social Security that we were talking about a minute ago, then we are beginning to see that there will be, I think, some reason to believe that this wage gap is going to shrink, because the younger women coming in, as we mentioned before, are more likely to come in with at least a college degree. And they're coming in strong numbers, they're coming in well prepared, they're coming in very qualified, and they're making good wages once they get there. So even though the wage gap isn't completely ameliorated among the young, it's certainly much smaller than it is as compared to those who are older.
But then there are the women who decide to give up their careers for a while to have families.
Exactly.
So that affects the whole seniority and longevity aspect of work.
It affects seniority, and that ends up impacting years of experience, which ends up impacting the sort of salary that one can demand. And once again, I think that's largely a cultural function as well. That's another angle to this whole difference between the African-American woman and the white woman's work experience and earnings level. Because, African-American women have never had the tradition of staying at home. Since the days that African-American women were brought to these shores, they were, in fact, expected to work. And even when, we had the great women's movement that kind of opened up employment opportunities specifically for white women, for example, black women have sort of always been in the workforce, even as domestics or agricultural workers, even before they were allowed opportunities into the corporate world, for it, as a sense.
And that's because, as you said earlier, they play a more important role in most families as wage earners. Many white women, especially if they have husbands who earn well, have the option of choosing a career or of staying at home.
They do, but in addition to that sort of economic necessity, I think, that we find there, I think there's also this cultural tradition, whereas, for example, white girls may have grown up in homes where it was normal for her mother to be home with her, whereas black girls may not have had that same experience. For her, it's normal for the mother to go out and work, so she doesn't see it as in any way neglectful or unfeminine, for example, to go out and work and bring home that paycheck.
Dr. Avis Jones DeWeaver is my guest. She is from the Institute for Women's Policy Research, and this is Underreported on WNYC 93.9 AM 820 online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When women take time off for family reasons like having children, they're not just losing earnings, are they? They're not contributing to their Social Security or retirement plans during
those
times.
Exactly. And those things come back to haunt her later in life. Women end up living longer than men, and she really needs that extra income coming in. It really really hurts her opportunities for having an above poverty level wage once she retires. And it particularly is important because women are more likely, for example, to work in those low-paying jobs that I mentioned before, jobs that don't usually have access to 401k plans or pension plans or anything like that. So women are more likely than men to rely only on Social Security and retirement age than her male counterparts. part. So it's particularly sort of important, and it particularly hurts her, for example, when she takes those that time off during those early years of her children to stay home and be there for them.
Well, one of the big issues with the women's movement for a while was whether staying at home, what constituted real work, and that has been kind of ignored, hasn't it? That you don't hear much about that anymore. That's something that was discussed a lot more in the 60s and 70s.
Right. Unfortunately, that's a debate that, you know, we still haven't really given that much credence to. It's unfortunate that people aren't considering, for example, the work of raising children as real work, and it's work that is worthy of compensation. So I think there is definitely more that needs to be done in order to make sure that those individuals who do take that time off to be with their children in their early years don't lose out in the end when she's an elderly woman, and because of that she's penalized and doesn't have enough money to really make ends meet at the time when she's most vulnerable in her life.
Unions were once a lot stronger in this country than they are now. How are they dealing with this gap? Are they addressing it?
Well, I will say that I wouldn't say that they're specifically putting forth some sort of political effort for it, but I will say that women who are in unions do tend to earn more than women who are not in unions, and women who are in unions are more likely to have access to benefits than women who are not in unions. So being in a union is a good thing for a woman. It increases her earning potential and increases her likelihood of having the sort of perfection of sick leave, having those basic benefits that most individuals kind of expect, but that a lot of working parents and families don't have access to.
Getting back to that census survey, one of the big factors in the wage gap is class. And can a survey reflect class, race, and sex and as combined influences and come up with any real answers?
It can give us a lot of information. I mean, the data is there. It depends on how we choose to interpret and how we choose to use it. One example of that I give you that I think is a very interesting story that, once again, wasn't really picked up on by the media is if you look at this issue of those individuals who don't have a bachelor's degree, looking just at women, interestingly enough, once again, we find that Asian American women earn the most. Now, then comes white women, then African American women and Latinas, but I raised that point because I think it's important to note that I think a large reason why Asian American women, for example, at the lowest level of education still earn the most is because of a larger likelihood among these women to go into entrepreneurial opportunities. And so I think that we can learn something from that. We can say to women who do not have benefit of a college education, look into owning a business, look into starting a business, because you'll have a much greater likelihood to earn more there than you will in earning a low wage, in earning a good amount of money with working in a low wage job.
The data indicate that 71% of students from families with incomes under $20,000 graduated with debt in the years 1999-2000. Only 44% of students from families with incomes of more than $100,000. So they are beginning with a burden, and then those low-income backgrounds families don't help with expenses after college. They're less likely to say, well, you know, we'll give you a couple of years to find yourself. You can intern, do something like that. So that must affect earnings as well.
Oh, it's a big factor. And in fact, that fact alone turns a lot of low-income families off to even examining the higher education option at all. Low-income individuals are more likely to be wary of taking out student loans, so they're less likely to go to college. And even among those who do go, as you mentioned, they end up graduating with more debt because they needed to amass that debt in order to get a degree. And oftentimes, they're the only one in their family or one of the first ones in their family to have benefit of a college degree. And so when they do start on that work world, they're having to really help support a larger net in terms of their extended family. So it's a very huge crisis on them. One thing that can be done about that is to increase Pell Grants. I mean, the Pell Grant allowances in this country are minuscule. It really, the value of it has fallen tremendously over the years because most of the extra money that's gone into higher education in terms of helping to make it more affordable have basically benefited middle and upper class individuals because most of that money has gone into merit-based awards for individuals who graduate from, with 4.5 GPAs, or into giving tax cuts to individuals who pay for college and then are able to write that off of their taxes. That doesn't help families who are so poor that they're not paying in a large amount of taxes. So most of the benefits that's gone to making college education more affordable, in fact, hasn't even gone to those individuals who would most likely need it.
In fact, many people have complained that many of the scholarships that we see going to minority people are to middle-class minority kids rather than to the kids who would need the scholarship the most.
Well, once again, I don't think that is exclusive to people of color. That's just been the way of how scholarship funding has gone now for the past 20 years or so. Most of the scholarship funding has gone to merit-based awards. And so that would benefit high academic performers who are African-American, Latinas, or white, and of whatever class level. But unfortunately, the highest performers tend to be of higher economic background, and that's largely a function of the types of schools that they end up going to. Frankly, schools that primarily service middle and upper income individuals are more likely to have access, for example, to AP courses, which give individuals opportunities, frankly, to inflate their GPAs because it allows them the opportunity to make a 5-point for their A instead of a 4-point for their A for individuals who don't have access to AP courses. And so that provides them with the ability to have a higher GPA, which makes them more likely to win awards in terms of the merit scholarships.
Congress passed the Equal Pay Act in 1963. Has that made any difference?
It's made some difference, but I think that there is a lot more that we need to do. We really need to do a lot more in terms of just, broadly speaking, helping to change the overall culture in our society in terms of valuing individuals, all individuals, not just men, not just whites, all individuals, and valuing the work that they do. And I think once we truly begin to do that culturally, we'll begin to see some differences in terms of how people are paid in the workforce.
Dr. DeWeva, thank you so much for participating in this underreported segment. Dr. Avis Jones-DeWeaver of the Institute for Women's Policy Research.